The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast.
That's true.
Any of the fire content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything.
Unless you're abusing people, then I have a problem maligning you.
Also, we're not doctors, psychologists, or wizards. We're just two non-experts trying to make you a friendly, informative podcast that helps you understand culty shit. Hey, everybody. Sarah Edmondson here.
And I'm Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy, Sarah's husband. And you're listening to
A Little Bit Culty,
a.k.a. ALBC, a podcast about what happens when devotion goes to the dark side.
We've been there and back again. A little about us. True story. We met and fell in love in a cult. And then we woke up and got the hell out of Dodge.
And the whole thing was captured in the HBO docuseries The Vow, now in its second season.
I also wrote about our experience in my memoir, Scarred, the true story of how I escaped Nexium, the cult that bound my life.
Look at us, a couple of married podcasters who just happen to have a weekly date night where we interview experts and advocates in things like cult awareness and mind control.
Wait. This does not count toward date night, babe. We got to schedule that. That's separate.
So there's 2 days we got to hang out?
We do this podcast thing because we learned a lot on our exit ramp out of Nexium, still on that journey, and we want to pay the lessons forward with the help of other cult survivors and whistleblowers.
We know all too well that culty things happen. It happens to people every day across every walk of life. So join us each week to tackle these culty dynamics, everywhere from online dating to megachurches and multi-level marketing.
This stuff really is everywhere. The cultiverse just keeps on expanding, and so are we. Welcome to Season 5 of A Little Bit Culty, serving cult content and word salads weekly on your favorite podcast platforms. Learn more at alittlebitculty.com. Hey, everybody.
Welcome back to the Cultiverse.
Breaking news. We are interrupting our normal programming and bumping this episode ahead of the normal schedule because we have some breaking news. I think it's important to know this is about something that's happening right now. There's a trial happening right now. And you probably, I'm not sure if you've been following it, but the Lori Vallow Daybell case has been in the news now for a number of years.
Shit is crazy.
It is next level.
I think Nexium's weird. Holy shit.
I was asked to speak on it, to be interviewed by Elizabeth Vargas a couple weeks ago. And when I did, I'm going to be totally honest, I did not know the depths to which I was uneducated
about this.
I don't think
anyone does until the trial's over.
Right. And we still don't know. Yeah. But one of our listeners recommended we talk to Leo Sotilli, who wrote an incredible book, and we'll be talking a lot about that. But just a little bit of backstory.
Lori Vallow is a 49-year-old American woman arrested in Hawaii in 2019 after her 17-year-old daughter, Tylee Ryan, and her 7-year-old son, Joshua, JJ, went missing in Idaho. What the police uncovered during the freakish and deeply disturbing investigation certainly points a finger at Vallow for the death of her two children, whose bodies were tragically discovered in shallow graves.
Also, this would be a good time to, again, say this is very dark and certainly needs a trigger warning. The current inmate, Lori Vallow, also seems to be linked to the suspicious deaths of her previous husband, as well as the wife of her new husband, Chad Daybell. The allegedly murderous couple came to be after Vallow began obsessively reading Daybell's apocalyptic texts instead of just checking, like, the New York Times bestseller list for books that aren't 100% unhinged.
At the time of this recording, Vallow is still on trial in Boise, which makes it all more timely and appropriate to speak with today's guest, freelance journalist and author, Leah Sotilli. Sotilli's book, When the Moon Turns to Blood, Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell, and the Story of Murder, Faith, and End Times, illuminates the story of the former beauty queen and her gravedigger turned doomsday novelist slash extremist husband.
Furthermore, the book asks the question, what's the bigger picture around today's doomsday culture? We loved our conversation with Leah, and in case you somehow don't get it to the end, she has agreed to do a live Zoom over on Patreon the week this podcast airs, or perhaps the week after, depending on our mutual schedules. So please join us over there so you can ask her questions directly, because this is very complicated. And if you do want to be on that Zoom, we recommend you read the book first to understand all of the people, all the characters involved in this absurdly challenging case to wrap your head around.
Yeah, at the very least, find out the updates in the case. And I think she'll be there and she'll be able to give us kind of the inside scoop, because one of the things that even just reading this in the introduction, it's hard to read, but it's also somewhat emotionally disconnected. And one of the things I don't like about headlines is, you know, I think the emotion's important because it helps people understand it and helps other people understand nuance. And Leah brings that. So without further ado, Sarah.
Leah Sottile. Leah, welcome to A Little Bit Culty.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good times, about the end times.
Yes. Wow. There you go.
Hold it all together right there. First of all, we've been talking about this case a little bit in the podcast, and I said, I just don't know who to interview, because I was trying to like figure out all the different characters. There's so many people involved. And then one of our audience members suggested your book, and I was like, I wish that I had read it before I was interviewed by Elizabeth Vargas. I really did not understand the complexity of this case when I was interviewed about it. So I appreciate you.
It is wild.
It's wild.
There's so many moving parts, and it certainly has a salacious headlines, and we're going to have to transcend all that to get the human element of this.
How did you come across this case, and what's your personal journey with end times and extremism?
Yeah. So personal journey is just that I have been a journalist writing about political and religious extremism for like the last decade or so. And I grew up Catholic. I went to Catholic school, kind of thought that was what most people believed. You know, you only grow up knowing what you know. But at a certain point in my journalism career, I started to become really interested in the LDS faith. I live in Oregon. And, you know, I think it's hard to tell the history of the West without talking about the history of the Mormon Church. So it became something that I started researching sort of out of interest, but also out of necessity in writing about political extremism, specifically because I've done a ton of work on anti-government militias. We had an armed takeover of a wildlife refuge that went on for 41 days in 2016.
Remember that?
And that was something I reported on that a ton. And the whole gist of that was it was led by a family who had really specific beliefs about what they thought the Mormon faith obligated them to do. So really, it was because I had this kind of foundational background that there were people in like anti-government circles that had really radical, you know, completely fringe, unaccepted by the mainstream church in Salt Lake City beliefs, that when I heard about Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell and that they were missing, I'd read a headline in, I want to say December 2019, when they disappeared, which I'm sure we'll get into, that someone had speculated that maybe it had to do with their end times beliefs or their cult-like beliefs, I think it was the quote. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I just kind of come off of all this work on these fringe LDS beliefs. And I thought, well, that'd be interesting if this kind of yoga mom and this guy that's involved in his church believe the same things as these militia guys that I've just finished writing about. And it turned out they really did, in a way. So that's how it started for me, was just kind of wondering like, I wonder if they believe the same things. And that's just was the beginning of a very long rabbit hole.
It kind of seems too that it's an unlikely reach for those extreme beliefs, that it's actually getting into a little bit more mainstream with these two characters, wouldn't you say?
100%. Yes. I think that to me was one of the most chilling realizations as I was reporting on this book, was that, you know, it's one thing when like a bunch of guys with AR-15s and like fatigues and all the militia, you know, uniform show up and start scaring people and they have radical religious beliefs. It's a whole other thing when it's a guy who serves in the priesthood of his church and a mom who teaches Sunday school are also talking about the same thing. So yeah, to me, I was like, whoa, maybe this is a sign of these beliefs mainstreaming.
Well, I was very appreciative of how you were able to do so much investigative journalism in terms of painting the picture of like the very complicated tapestry of the backdrop for both of these people and how they were raised. And it just made sense to me. Like, obviously, it's totally not in reality their beliefs, but given the way they were raised, it made sense to me how they got to that point. And so for those people who don't know anything about the case, I know it's going to be hard to summarize it, but in the best way you can, and maybe I could ask the question if you could, you know, give a brief timeline, but also like what were the circumstances in their upbringing that you see led to them being where they are now?
Sure. Yeah. So to me, this book is what, it's like 350 pages. And it was a very long study of me trying to figure out how Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow, two people with wild religious beliefs, could meet. Like, what were the circumstances that would bring two people that had these beliefs together, especially if they were so as fringe as everybody says? So to me, in order to answer that, I had to go back all the way to the beginning of their lives, which is often what I feel like I do on extremism work, is I just go as deeply as I can and tell their story of their upbringing. You know, were these ideas that they learned or from their parents? Was it passed down to them? Was it intergenerational? So in the case of Lori Vallow, she was raised in Southern California in the San Bernardino area, raised it by all means in a very traditional California American household. You know, she was a cheerleader. She was the kind of young Mormon who went to like a religious school every day before she went to her public high school. Raised in a big family, you know, they went to church every week, but they also, you know, kind of were living this more lavish lifestyle. They went to Hawaii a lot. The father ran for city council at a certain point. What I started to realize was that at a certain point, Lori's father, his name is Barry Cox, he started to develop a pretty serious anti-government belief system. So to me, you know, this was the world I was familiar with. Like, okay, here's something interesting that isn't normal, I would say. He decided he didn't want to pay the IRS anymore. And I think that's a really common thing. That's a common point of radicalization for a lot of people, is that they're like, why should I pay the federal government all these taxes? So at a certain point, he developed this idea that he didn't need to pay his taxes, and he started writing about it. So, you know, fast forward way, all the way forward to when this case started. On the day that Lori Vallow was arrested in March of 2020 in Hawaii, her father published a book about how Americans can fight the IRS. And it's about him bringing this like anti-tax sovereign citizen belief system together with his faith, with what he believes is, you know, talked about in the Book of Mormon. So I think that's the short story of Lori Vallow, is that she was raised in a household where her dad stopped paying taxes. That was something that happened when she was in high school. She then went through a variety of marriages that went awry. And I think that's probably the best I can describe her. Chad Daybell, who is her fifth husband. And these are not, just to be clear, they weren't polygamous. Like, she was not married to the other people anymore.
Although there was some overlap between Charles and Chad.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Definitely overlap in the affair realm, not the polygamy realm, but yes. So Chad Daybell was raised really in the kind of like breadbasket of Mormonism in the Provo, Utah area, which is where Brigham Young University is. You know, he's just your kind of classic Mormon story, knows all of his pioneer ancestors that came west, that settled into Utah. He described himself as a scripture nerd, and that he was the kind of guy who would drive around his small town and people would think, oh, him and his friends are out cruising for girls, but really they were just talking about scripture. He actually writes this, so it's like he's like a Bible nerd. He goes to BYU, he studies journalism, he goes on a mission, you know, kind of does all the like A to Z of what you're supposed to do as a good Mormon guy. And eventually he starts to become really interested in the stories of near-death experiences, which is a big part of the book that I wrote, is talking about why near-death experiences are appealing to some people on the fringes of the LDS church. Essentially, he, at a certain point, claimed he had had two near-death experiences, which I asked his brother about, and he was like, yeah, that's news to me. I've never heard of him having near-death experiences. But I think what Chad Daybell realized was that near-death experiences could give him a sort of certain celebrity within fringe LDS circles. He was an aspiring writer and was having a really hard time selling his books. And all of a sudden, when he became a near-death experience celebrity, I would say, and that's, you know, air quotes around the word celebrity, because it was a pretty small world, but he could get kind of, you know, some fame for that. So he talked about his near-death experiences, how it gave him a certain access to the spirit world, how he could see beyond the veil and speak to, you know, his ancestors and things like that. And So at a certain point, Chad really kind of goes from this pretty, you know, normal Mormon guy into this world of fringe near-death experiences and coming up with these kind of wacky spiritual ideas. And I say wacky because they are seen by people, I would even say probably at the edges of the Mormon church is really out there. So yeah, he starts kind of traveling around these circuits, selling his books, doing speeches, talking about his ideas. And these are the circumstances with which Lori and Chad eventually meet in 2018 in Utah at one of these conferences.
So fringe belief overlaps.
Yes, yes, exactly. So and in this kind of quest to become a public figure in that world, he started doing podcasts. And it sounds to me like Lori Vallow had started hearing some of those podcasts and she was reading his books and things like that. And that she came and, you know, there's sort of a scene I put in the book that he's selling books at a table. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like this, the crowd parts and this beautiful blonde walks toward him and they just are, you know, starry eyed for each other and fall in love immediately. And he tells her apparently that same day, you know, we were married in a past life, which to me, you know, if somebody said that to me, I would be so creeped out. But to Lori Vallow, she was like, yes, we were. I think like pretty early in this case, they're kind of developed this like real fascination with Lori Vallow. Like people started calling her the Doomsday Mommy and Doomsday Mother, and they were the Doomsday Couple and stuff. And I think I talk a bit about that in the book, that there was this kind of like, you know, people got really obsessed with her and why she is the way she is.
Yeah. And well, I do think that was quite well explained in your book. Also, just the element of like her being so devoted to the church, but that's not really a place where women can shine. And then, you know, Chad giving her this, like basically an ego boost of like, no, you're a goddess warrior. You know, I mean, I can't imagine many women who wouldn't like to hear that from a man. Like,
sure.
It sounds great. Nippy, who's a goddess warrior?
I mean, 10 years right? in, Sarah, who do you think?
Right? Like I get that psychology. I mean, we call it love bombing, right? Like whether it was manipulative or true for him, he certainly, you know, boosted her. The other kind of ironic slash, it's not like proof, but it just fits into the whole picture of his history as a gravedigger.
Yeah, you know, that's often a part of it that I totally forget about. That I think Chad's first book was called One Foot in the Grave. He wrote two memoirs, so it was the first of his memoirs, and it's about his life as a gravedigger in this small town in Utah, and how it's really weird. I mean, it's weird for a lot of reasons, but you read it in, you know, knowing what we know now, and he comes off as just this kind of like small town gossip, sort of making fun of people who are mourning or just kind of generally inconvenienced by people needing, you know, funeral arrangements and things like that. Really sort of callous. But I thought it was very interesting. Like, this is somebody who has positioned themselves to be near death in as many ways as he can. You know, from a young age, he was making money off being a gravedigger. Then all of a sudden, he needed to be this near-death experience guy. It's like, it's a long-time fascination for him.
Can you tell us in the audience a little bit about the shared beliefs that they have? Like, where does the LDS belief system end? And where does it go into their reality? Like, what's the main crux of that?
So I think the best way to answer that is that, and to be honest with you, like I didn't grow up LDS or anything, so this is all just from my own reporting. The LDS church does allow each individual member to receive revelation in a way, to essentially have like a personal relationship with God, to talk to God, to receive, you know, instructions and messages from God. Where the church is very clear is that when revelation kind of walks out the front door of your house, so you could talk to your family about it, you could talk to your wife and say, God told me that we should do X, Y, or Z. But when that walks out the front door and starts to make itself public and broadcast to other people, that's when things become really problematic. And that's really where Chad and Lori got themselves sideways with the church. Because Chad would say, you know, I basically saw these visions of the world ending. You know, to me, it's sort of this kind of funny chicken or egg thing. Like if you allow people to receive revelation and that revelation is very scary and, you know, world ending potentially, you might want to tell other people about that. But the church, you know, has been really clear over the years. You can't go start broadcasting these things and claiming that you're a prophet and things like that. But the LDS church has this really long history of people doing that, of saying, you know, okay, thanks, but no thanks, leadership. Like, I received a revelation that was so powerful to me that I need to go start spreading that word. This is why the LDS Church has so many different schismatic breakaway groups that have said, like, no, don't listen to them anymore. I'm the one with the true gospel. You know, I hold that. So, you know, as far as specific beliefs, I think it's important to say that a lot of schismatic groups with the LDS Church are based around polygamy, where they say, you know, the prophet of the church revealing that we don't practice polygamy anymore. Yeah, I don't buy it. I think that that's what Joseph Smith, the prophet and founder of the LDS Church, wanted. So a lot of those schismatic groups are around the ability to practice polygamy. When it comes to Chad and Lori, they didn't specifically believe, like, they're, I kind of talk about, like, is what they believed polygamy? Because they believed in something they called multiple probations, which is that essentially, you know, Chad and Lori were married in a past life. And so when they met each other, they were like, oh, we're still married. But simultaneously, Lori was married to a man named Charles Vallow, and Chad was married to a woman named Tammy Daybell. To me, isn't that kind of polygamy if you're, you know, believing you're married to more than one? It's like they had this kind of strange, like, sci-fi timeline that they were living on, making this whole polygamy thing even weirder.
To justify it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there was a lot of things like that. They also believed in things they would call castings, where they would hold these kind of group meetings and sort of visualize that they were sending, you know, dark or light energy at people that they thought were kind of getting in their way. So I think the best example of that is that Lori Vallow's fourth husband, Charles Vallow, he was, you know, really questioning a lot of these meetings she was going to, her relationship with Chad Daybell. And so all of a sudden she sort of developed this idea that he was not even himself anymore. He'd been invaded by a demon spirit, and it was up to her and her close friends to kind of, like, send this energy at him and try and kill him or make sure his car drove off the road and things like that. So none of these things are recognizable to Mormons. They're just like this interpretation of an interpretation of beliefs. But it does fit in a kind of wacky history that the LDS Church has to kind of consistently deal with, of people who just kind of go and decide, this is what Mormonism looks like. We are the true church.
This is the golden age of cult recovery. The more we speak up and share our stories, the more we realize we are not alone. Your voice and your story can empower others. This is Sarah, and I'm proud to be a founding collaborator of the hashtag IGotOut movement. Learn more at IGotOut.org.
Well, it does fit in terms of the process of how Mormonism breaks off to justify other belief system, which is the foundation of the religion in the first place. So it is kind of fitting that it would take on that kind of emulation of that behavior in order to justify Absolutely. Whatever they want to do.
Do you mean like Joseph Smith just coming up with this, like, I held some crystals and talked to Moroni and now I'm the leader? Like, you mean like that? Like people just saying, I talked to God? Is that what you mean? Yeah.
You know, and I think it's been very interesting to me as somebody who, you know, reports on religion. I think it's the history of the LDS Church is so new. You know, we can look and tell that story that just happened like 200 some odd years ago. So it starts to make you wonder which of these, you know, are all religions like this, where it's just like a guy with some crystals and a hat and, you know, some fabled golden tablets that only he can see? Maybe. I don't know.
They kind of are.
It kind of conveniently works out and everything works in their favor and they have the power, and it's never a vision that's positive. There's never a vision that comes back where they don't seem to have more control after the vision.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's never like, hey, listen, I had this vision. You guys should go do what you want. You know? I've been wrong this whole time. It's like, hey, you know,
I've had a vision.
Like, nah,
I need 80 wives.
Yep.
20 of them are going to be underage.
Give me your money.
And I'm just going to take advantage. No, but I know we're laughing, but also, like, this isn't a bang on Mormon people. I'm sure there's lots of lovely Mormons out there. It's more just the major problem of it being okay. Like, in some ways, as a not religious person, but I'm also like pseudo spiritual or something, that like, and I don't use the word God in my daily life, but like I call it the universe or whatever. But like to say someone has a direct line to God, in some ways, I think that's, you know, great to say you can connect to the, your, for me, it'd be like my true self, higher self, the universe, source, whatever. Like I don't make my decisions based on that. It's sort of like a knowing feeling, right? That sounds great. But when you take that and then start applying a belief system to everybody else of how everybody should be and making decisions, I think the word you used in your book was like your self-prescribed morality. No, what would you call it? Something about how you like, you decide, it's like your own morality that you're now imposing on everybody.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like you're the arbiter of the rules. And I think that's really smart the way you're saying it. Like it's about just sort of like packaging the beliefs in a way that, but like Lori was somebody who was raised Mormon. She very much wanted to be like the best Mormon woman that she could be and had gone through all of these different divorces and a lot of family strife and things like that. But Chad really spoke to her, I think, in a way that she was familiar with. He used terms and stories and, you know, scriptures that she knew. And so she could, you know, kind of, I think, be convinced of this. But I think that, you know, this is one thing I want to be sure to say, is that a big part of my reporting was also trying to figure out who was leading who here. Because I think that, like, to me, I came into it seeing, to be honest, like I saw all of this like indictment of Lori Vallow, you know, it was all her. But I thought, well, what about this other guy? Like, is it possible that he could be, you know, that she was brainwashed in some way? Like, you know, being a feminist, like thinking like maybe we need to like give this lady a little grace. But then as I got into the reporting, I started to actually wonder maybe she was leading him, that she had this kind of long history of familial violence towards her partners and things like that. So I don't know if you want to get into that at all, but yeah.
I guess the question is who's using coercive control over whom, right?
And how do you define coercive control? I mean, you both would be able to tell me more than I would.
Well, as I understand it, we've interviewed some people that are trying to get the courts to understand it. One of the things in our case in specific is part of the reason law enforcement didn't take it entirely serious at first is because they didn't know what they were looking at. Meaning, when Sarah's case, she agreed to something, but it was under a false premise, right? So it was kind of a bait and switch. So what she was agreeing to in the initial deal wasn't exactly what the people that had in mind, right? So Sarah was agreeing to the brand, but it wasn't Keith's initials she was agreeing to. And then it was collateralized with, you know, her agreement or whatever.
And also that there was the blackmail being held over me that I had to obey, right? But part of my commitment of joining this group was that to obey every command from Lauren. And it was supposed to be things about my growth. And the actual definition, I just looked it up, just what's on the internet, is coercive control is an act or pattern of or acts of assault, threats, humiliation, and intimidation, or other abuse that's used to harm, punish, or frighten the victim. So it's coercing someone to do something they wouldn't normally do using any one of those things. Like I wouldn't have done that.
It's a gun to the head. It's a gun to the head.
Yeah, emotional gun to the head.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they're doing it to each other, but in the case of, it sounds like in this one, you know, she's the easy one to come down on because of the salacious headlines. But upon further investigation, it's more nuanced and there's way more things that are informing how these things come into fruition.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting to think about if coercive control was a part of this. I mean, they had people around them that believed what they believed and did what they said, but they seemed to be really, really careful about who they shared their ideas with. So specifically, I remember there was a woman who was very close to Lori and Chad, and she had texted Chad at one point and said, "Hey, I'm going to bring a friend of mine to this meeting that we're having. You know, I think she'd be great for you to talk to." And he was like, no, she's not ready yet. And so he was really, really careful, I think, about who he would share these ideas with. And I don't know if that's because he was afraid of the mainstream church finding out and excommunicating him, because this is like the fastest way that you get crosswise with the church, or if there was something more there. But when it comes to Chad and Lori, I mean, I think that they had, you know, proverbial guns to each other's heads.
And it also seemed like their group, because when Elizabeth Vargas first reached out about like the cult connection, it's not super, I mean, I saw culty things, but it wasn't super well published, because I hadn't read your book yet, that they had started a group. But that's different than preparing a people and the internet avow, a voice of warning. Those are two, can you just explain all sort of those two groups and how that kind of was a pipeline to their group?
Totally. Yeah. So First, Preparing a People was a circuit of conferences that kind of takes place in the Intermountain West. So Idaho, Utah, Arizona, these areas of the country that are very heavily LDS. And for people who don't know, there is this kind of thing within Mormonism called preparedness doctrine, where people, you know, have prepper stores. So they, you know, stock up on water and medical supplies and, you know, things like that as a way of being prepared for any eventual issues like an earthquake or, you know, just natural disasters. It's like a very normal thing within normal Mormonism. However, people take things to the extreme. So, you know, with Preparing a People, it was catered towards Mormons who were really prepping up, believing that the end of the world was coming. You know, I think it's important, you know, the name of the church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And that Latter-day bit is super key here because it's about the part of the book of Revelation where it's prophesied that, you know, the world is going to end, Jesus will return, and there'll be all kinds of mayhem and things like that. And so Preparing a People was for the people who were like hardcore about that specific bit. And so it was about, you know, kind of looking for signs that the end was coming and what to do, and these kind of fringe ideas that Lori and Chad were talking about. Sort of adjacent to that is this website called Another Voice of Warning, of which I was a member for a very long time, trying to understand this ideology from the inside out. But it's a website for people who are in the Mormon church who are talking about things that the mainstream Mormon church would not be cool with, like multiple probations, like near-death experiences, like, you know, hardcore prepping up for the end times. And Chad really kind of found his audience on the Another Voice of Warning site. A lot of those same people, like Preparing a People, would get on there and give like discount codes and stuff for their conferences to the Another Voice of Warning crowd. So that was kind of their market that they were looking for, were these sorts of people.
Oh my goodness.
There's plenty out there.
Are you still a member of Avow?
I am not. No, at a certain point I was like, I cannot pay for this anymore.
But
no.
You know where to go. In case they're right.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually really surprised when I was reporting the book. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like they want to divorce themselves from Chad Debo, but all of his posts are still here. So I was able to just kind of like look back at everything he had ever written on there and saw how he was kind of like picking around for other near-death experience stories and things like that.
I love how you called him an LDS Nostradamus. And also you called him white bread without crusts. These are the three quotes I wrote down. And that you said that the covers of his book were the Panera of book covers.
Yeah, I mean, you're picking up on all the shade I was trying to put out there.
Your shade was so perfect. I mean, I without having like done the deep dive that you did, I really got the gist.
Well, you're hitting on something I think is really interesting about Chad and Lori. I think that sparks some of the fascination as you look at her and like, you know, objectively, before this happened, she was a bombshell. Like she was a, you know, beautiful woman and, you know, had this kind of like really wealthy lifestyle and things like that. And you're like, that guy, like Chad Debo wears these kind of clothes that look too big for him, that when he talks, he's really unsure of himself. He carries himself like a really insecure person. And so it was kind of interesting to me to kind of go through that thought process of like, why him? Like, what's so appealing about that guy?
I think it is what you said. It's how, what he gave to her. And also like, just based on your reporting and from what it looks like, she did seem to be like the kind of woman who knew how to manipulate men and also law enforcement and people around her to get what she wanted. And the word grifter comes to mind.
How much do you think like the current political climate, the current kind of distrust in media, government, et cetera, plays into this and makes them maybe more a little bit more susceptible to these belief systems, or maybe they prey on people that are having certain doubts about the political climate and the division that's going on in our world right now, and that makes them a little bit more, it accelerates it a little bit.
So I'm really glad you asked that, because I think that for me, you know, this was an extension of the work that I've done on extremism. And I was very much seeing this case as it's an extension of this kind of political divide that we feel like we're all living in right now. I think it's important to talk about that within the history of the LDS Church is this kind of persecution complex. It's very, very real. Like we said, this is all really recent history. So there were multiple moments in the history of the LDS Church where people were persecuted for believing in Joseph Smith, for believing, you know, supposedly, you know, you have freedom of religion in the Constitution, but they felt like that was not somehow being applied to them. So like when the Mormons came west and they were in Utah, there were raids of polygamous homes by the federal government, you know, homes burned to the ground and things like that. And over the years, as I have reported on Mormonism, I've come to understand that story is one that has been passed down from generation to generation. And I think that infuses this hardcore prepper mentality, like prep up for an earthquake or a volcano eruption, or if the federal government comes in and starts like burning people's houses down.
There's a history between the church and the government.
Yes. And a real, real distrust. So when I started writing about these militia guys that took over the wildlife refuge and went and interviewed their family, you know, they told stories about their town in Nevada was subjected to nuclear fallout from the Nevada testing site. You know, their whole town of LDS people were, you know, all of a sudden had cancer. And so that was kind of one more moment that people could point to and be like, look, the government will screw you. And so we don't trust them. So I think that like is on the wind in a way, that kind of distrust of the government in the Intermountain West. And then when you all of a sudden have in 2018, 2019, this kind of real political fear going on, that was great for Chad Daybell's book sales because he could all of a sudden say, see all this stuff that's happening? And he even says it in the beginning of his books, you know, this thing I talked about in the last book, weirdly, it came true.
So do you think it's justified from your perspective? Do you think like there's legitimate, like, from their perspective, do you feel like it's a legitimate concern or do you think it's something that's being played up, leveraged by Chad or both?
Yeah, you know, I think you look at the history, sure. Like you kind of wonder how can there be freedom of religion and also this oppression of this very specific group? You know, I think that gets into a lot of conversations about that Joseph Smith in the beginning wanted to run for president. There were voting blocks and things like that people were trying to tamp down. So I understand it, but I, as a way of understanding how people's belief systems could go extreme. So, you know, I don't think it's justified. You know, for me, I'm always looking like what that causal relationship is. So I think, yeah, but for people like Chad and all the preparing of people, you know, there's all these other conferences that kind of shop these conspiracy theories about why the world is the way it is. They're just seeing like there's just a market there waiting for it to be like, oh yeah, of course, this totally plays into the way we're thinking. We got to buy this guy's books because he's going to show us the way and things like that.
Okay. So we have a family member who's a prepper, but not religious.
Interesting.
I have a friend who has another friend that we were talking about. And I was commenting on how he reminded me of my older brother. And they both work in finance. They both recognize that the flow of money is how they make a lot of their decisions. And it's a lot of the behaviors in finance are precursors for what's to come and what might be coming. And based on markets, they prepare themselves. So I mean, you may say the market has its own kind of religious flavor to it as well, but there are certainly some precursors that might indicate, oh, these are hard times coming here, stock up on this and that. My brother has an affinity to guns, and I think it's just kind of gone into a way of justifying buying guns.
Needless to say, after reading this book, I might become a prepper, not for religious reasons, but I'm not prepared, and I like to be prepared. I'm prepared in my day-to-day with like a purse with like lip balm and tampons and things like that, but I'm not prepared for anything bad to happen beyond that. So it's inspired me.
I think, well, it's interesting you would have that reaction because like I was writing this book during, you know, the moments when people were pushing around the, you know, towering shopping carts of toilet paper at Costco or whatever during the 2020 early days of the pandemic. And to me, it was a bit of a like difficult thing for me to wrap my head around. Like, is there something about these people that makes them right? You know, I think it's interesting. I also think based on what you were saying, Nippy, like the very first story that I did on extremism was in 2014. I wrote a story for Playboy about a guy with the most hardcore prepper stores I had ever met. And it wasn't religiously motivated at all. He just didn't trust the government. He was super freaked out about Obama. And he decided he had this huge RV that he gave me a tour of. And it was just like every single crevice and cranny of it was packed with ammo and canned food. And, you know, his whole thing was like canned chow mein, which to me sounds like the worst possible thing you would have in the end times. But, you know, and tons of guns. And he was basically like, the only thing holding me back from hooking this thing up to my truck and pulling away is my wife. And like, she thinks this is crazy. And basically, like, it's going to be on her in a certain point, because I'm going to just hook this thing up and drive away when the end times happen. So to me, it was the beginning of being fascinated of like, so what does life look like for you afterwards? Like, why do you want to survive in this like hellscape that you see coming?
That's exactly my argument to my brother. I'm like, okay, so like you live an extra 3 to 6 months for what? Right. Like, you can't
sounds
do anything.
Sounds kind of crappy.
Like, I mean, okay, yeah. You live off the land, but then the last 20 years of your life are like,
I'm too much of a princess to live in that world.
100%.
Like, where am I going to sleep? Yeah, what is my bed going to be like?
It becomes like the people that survive it are going to be extreme people.
Yeah.
So you're going to build an extreme culture right back up.
We digress. Hey there, listener. Hope you're enjoying this episode and that you're remembering to hydrate, stretch, and unclench your jaws. Sometimes listening to conversations about heavy topics can really make you tighten up, you know? And remember, a little bit culty loves you. Also, come hang out with us on Patreon after you finish this episode. It's fun over there. Fun is good. And now, here's a brief message from our sponsors. Back to the case. So you spent 2 weeks attending Valo's trial. What was that like?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it was wild. So I think it's like day 21 today of the trial. I was there for the first week, which was jury selection, which was fascinating in its own right, because you were hearing, you know, they had to go through, I think, 150 people to find the jury that they have, because there's just been so much media saturation of this case, specifically in Idaho. They had to move the case from eastern Idaho 4 hours west to Boise, to the biggest city in Idaho. And even then, it was really hard to find people who didn't know about it. So that was interesting. They really were trying to get anybody off the jury with religious beliefs or who are parents. They didn't, you know, the defense team definitely didn't want a lot of people who had little kids on the jury. And then the very first week of the prosecution presenting its arguments was fascinating. And to me, it was my goal to sit in the courtroom with Lori Vallow. And so I was sitting like 15 feet from her and trying to kind of like look at this person and wonder if she really is guilty of everything that she's accused of. Like, yeah, I still can't see it. Like, you look at her and she looks like the most normal person in the world.
And for our audience who doesn't know, what is she accused of?
Yeah, so she is accused of first-degree murder of her two children, 7-year-old JJ Vallow and her daughter, 16-year-old Tylee Ryan. Both of them were found dead in Chad Daybell's backyard about 6 months after she was arrested in Hawaii. She's also accused of conspiracy to murder of both of the children, but also conspiracy to murder Chad Daybell's wife, Tammy, of 29 years, who dropped dead very suddenly in October of 2019. So, you know, the timeline of this story is a couple of years long, but really it's July 2019 to October of that year when Lori Vallow's fourth husband, Charles Vallow, is suddenly shot to death by her brother, Alex. Then she all of a sudden picks up and moves to Idaho, where she starts, you know, basically having an affair with Chad Daybell under the nose of his wife. Her daughter disappears. Her son disappears. Tammy Daybell, Chad's wife, all of a sudden drops dead at age 49, a, you know, extremely healthy woman. And then they get married.
2 weeks later. 2 weeks later,
yes,
after Tammy dies. Yep.
Yeah, 2 weeks later. Yet just yesterday, there was a bunch of testimony around that people involved in the LDS church in the town that they lived in Idaho sort of saying, we knew Tammy, she was wonderful. And then all of a sudden, they had a funeral for her just a few days after she died. And Chad was getting married 2 weeks later. And we all were just kind of confused about what to do with that.
So they're kind of stupid.
In what way?
Well, like, it seems like it's overt.
Well, the other charges that Lori is facing, I should talk about, are grand theft, that she was cashing in the insurance policies of her children. So there's kind of a complicated story around that. But essentially, what the prosecution is arguing right now is that they were living off of the insurance policies of Charles Vallow, of Tammy Daybell, of an insurance policy that J.J. Vallow got when his father, Charles, died, and an insurance policy that Tylee Ryan got when her father, Lori Vallow's third husband, also died. And that's a part of this story that isn't really getting talked about as much in court, is that, you know, with the exception of Lori's first two husbands, husband three and husband four died in pretty sudden and tragic ways. And I think that there is a lot of speculation around whether or not Lori also maybe was involved in the death of her third husband.
Heart attack, was that right?
He had a heart attack and was found dead in bed. The other person we haven't really talked about here, if you want to get your mind blown, Nippy, is Lori Vallow's brother, Alex Cox, who is sort of seen by Chad and Lori as this sort of guardian angel for Lori. When Lori's third husband was found dead in his apartment of a supposed heart attack, he had just gone through, they'd gone through quite the, you know, horrible child custody deliberations over Tylee Ryan, their child. And after that was all said and done, Joseph Ryan, who was her husband, he did have some custody of Tylee. But on one specific occasion, he was chased down in a parking lot by Lori's brother, Alex, and tased. And Alex went to jail for that. So then fast forward to fourth husband, Charles, he was shot to death by Lori's brother, Alex. And then, yes. And then now the prosecution is building this case that Alex Cox's phone was in Chad Daybell's backyard in the specific places the children were buried on the last days they were ever seen alive. So there's kind of this thought that Chad and Lori, you want to talk about coercive control, that they were forcing Alex to maybe potentially be their hitman.
Can I also tell you how mind blown I am at this moment about something else that's totally weird?
Yes.
I did look on IMDb, and yes, the movie is called, I guessed it, Doomsday Mom. I swear to God, I hadn't looked at that before. It's got a rating of 5.3 out of 10, and it was clearly filmed in Vancouver because I know most of the actors. That's where I'm from. And guess who plays Alex Cox in real life?
Who?
Somebody I tried to recruit into NXIVM.
Oh, my God. Wow.
I'm going to text him later. It just comes full circle. Like, I think I have nothing full to do. Circle. I think I have nothing to do with this one. Nothing to do with it. But I was wrong.
Turns out maybe
Doomsday Mom, 5.3 out of 10, filmed in Vancouver. He's a really good actor, by the way. Really good actor. Anyway, I'm going to have to watch it now and see how well he plays Alex Cox. But like when I tried to like figure out all the players in this to be on Elizabeth Vargas's interview, I really couldn't wrap my head around it. I stayed very vague in regards to like coercive control and how cults can get extreme and things like that because there were just too many people. But your book really fills in all the backstory. And yeah, thank you for bringing that up about the tasers because I had forgotten about that part. Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a pattern.
Totally. And I think that's something that the defense really wants to keep out of the courtroom in Idaho right now is this whole backstory with the, you know, dead third husband and the tasing of him by Lori's brother. I think I should also probably say for people who don't know the timeline is that in December, when, you know, news came up that the kids were missing and things like that, all of a sudden Alex Cox dropped dead, the brother. So you've got all this kind of questions around. What happened? I know. It's not funny. I laugh because it's just sort of like when you hear people digest it for the first time, it is pretty mind-blowing.
But if I'm writing like a bad script, like if I'm too lazy to write, I was like, well, let's just kill him off. That's what it kind of feels like. It's like, it's just nuts.
And Lori and Chad had been on the phone with Alex in the hours and days before he died. He also died pretty conveniently on the day after Tammy Daybell's body was exhumed by the state of Utah, because all of a sudden there were sort of questions around like, hang on, these people are missing. These kids are missing. Isn't that the guy whose wife just all of a sudden dropped dead at age 49 a couple months ago? Better exhume her. So they exhumed her body and did an autopsy.
The results of that have not been released yet, correct?
They were released this week in court. So when it comes to Tylee Ryan, her body was in such a state that they said she was, you know, her cause of death was homicide by unspecified means. So obviously you look at what had happened to her, it was clear that it was homicide. JJ Vallo and Tammy Daybell were both asphyxiated. And when it comes to Tammy, she had bruises on her body that suggest that maybe she was held down and by someone and asphyxiated. So yeah, the idea, you know, Chad told in the moments after she died, oh, she had health problems, she had seizures, and it was just, yeah, it just made sense that she died, you know. To the medical examiner in Utah who has done apparently 7,200 autopsies in his career, he said there was no evidence of any of that. She died by asphyxiation. Dark.
It's so dark. And it, for those who haven't kept track, I'm trying to do it in my head. There's like seven bodies now. So there's, is that right? Joe, the third husband, Charles, the fourth husband, Alex, her brother, Tammy, Chad's wife, and then the two kids. Oh, six. Six?
Six. Yep. There is some speculation around way back in the past, Lori's sister died, and that supposedly, and I feel like I try and report on it in the best way that I can in the book, she died and she was alone with Alex Cox at the time. That was, you know, back way, way, way before all this started. So, but yeah, six to seven people, that's not a real normal.
No. It's not a coincidence.
Yeah. You also reported on this very carefully, but I'm wondering what your opinions are now, if you can say about how law enforcement didn't act properly a number of times along the way.
Well, sort of talking about what you all were saying with NXIVM, that like law enforcement didn't quite know what they were looking at. I think that that was definitely the case here. The sort of irony of it is that I feel like I have to bring up one other part of this that we didn't talk about.
Sure, yeah.
So Lori's niece was somebody that she recruited into this kind of group of casting, you know, energies on people. And at a certain point, right around when Tammy Daybell died, there was a drive-by shooting that was committed on her husband, the niece's husband. And the commonly held belief now is that Alex Cox drove Tylee Ryan's car down to Arizona and tried to shoot and kill this niece's husband. He had $1 million life insurance policy at the time. Obviously, the shooting didn't work out. He's alive and he testified in the case. So on the question of law enforcement, I think it's very interesting because I saw that when Charles Vallo was trying to get the police's attention, like my wife has lost her mind. She thinks she's a god. She thinks she's going to, you know, she has this wild LDS belief system that doesn't line up with what the mainstream church says. The cops really looked at him like he was the crazy one. And then later, the same police officer responded to the drive-by shooting that I just told you about. That police officer is LDS. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because you have people even that are police officers who are LDS not recognizing that this is maybe something they need to be aware of that's happening in this area of Arizona where they lived. So yeah, I think that also Lori was really believable. You know, you look at interviews that she did with detectives and you just see them take her side so quickly and say, oh yeah, your husband that's been calling the police about you, what a jerk, you know? And she really, wow, really had everybody wrapped around her fingers.
So from your perspective, what kind of psychology are you looking at in the players involved?
I think that's difficult to say. So since this has gone on, she was arrested, I guess, over 3 years ago. She has gone in and out of competency, as they say. So her ability to aid her in her defense has been hindered for years because she keeps going into mental hospitals in Idaho to be, you know, restored to competency. So details of her mental health have not come out. I have heard kind of secondhand that there are mental health issues in her family that I think could be, you know, hereditary. But yeah, beyond that, that's kind of all that I know. I don't really know.
Question, you did bring this up in your book. Why are you not okay with simply saying she's a sociopath?
Just because I'm not a psychologist and I couldn't get anybody to say that directly. So I just didn't feel comfortable, you know, speculating. I mean, sure. And to be honest with you, like I've written about some really dark stuff in my 20 years of being a journalist. Seeing the things that I saw in that courtroom, to me, there is no real way of explaining that people of clear mind could do those things specifically to children.
It's horrific.
It's truly, you know, I wrote this book. I spent so much time reporting on it. And then I sat there in the courtroom and thought to myself, this is so much darker than even I realized. It's
So,
I don't think that somebody that is thinking clearly could do that.
Yeah. I felt like your description of that was very empathetic. And also, you know, I feel like the term sociopath, especially in this case, shuts down a lot of like the road of trying to understand how somebody gets to this point, specifically with the backdrop of the Mormon church or an extreme version of it. And I think it's actually more responsible to not label her that way.
I think it's a great point, Sarah. I think it's the same thing. Like when you say, oh, it's a cult, people tend to go, oh, that doesn't apply to
me.
Oh,
it's a cult.
But if you say it's a group of people abusing their power, it leaves a little bit more open of like, well, how do they abuse your power? What do I need to be sensitive to? Similarly with calling them a psycho. What was the word? Psychopath?
Sociopath or psychopath. It's just a way to kind of end the conversation in some ways.
It shuts it down. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think it is, you know, for the LDS church, I think there's a lot of ways that they conjure the flames of these radical movements as much as they want to say that they're not a part of them. And I think it's important that they realize there are, you know, we talk all the time about how our society is rife with untreated mental illness. We don't know how to get a handle on that. Well, that means that there are going to be some people who have untreated mental illness that might get really excited about these fringe groups. And so I think that the church has to be really careful in making sure that they're not contributing to those getting bigger, or that this paranoia about the end of the world is outsized in a way.
And what else do you want people to know? Like you're the expert in this case, and so many people are following it from like 2020, you know, and that's not enough, which we've experienced also. So what do you want the world to know?
I think that to me it's frustrating because I think it's a case that gets just labeled as true crime, and because of that, that means, I mean, obviously it is true, there's many crimes as we have talked about, but it kind of reduces it to something that maybe a lot of people don't need to think about. I think what I try to argue in the book is that this is not an isolated case, that there are actually other cases of LDS fringe characters who killed people in the name of their belief system, that this isn't a fluke. This is a part of something that's been going on for a while, and it's going to keep going on. So I think to me, it's what is most important to me is that people realign their thinking to see this as a manifestation of religious extremism, as our political moment becomes, you know, as people get more and more freaked out about the world. You know, I hope we don't see more of this kind of thing, but I think that it's important to see it in that context instead of just like the serial killer, you know, true crimey blood and guts world.
And where does that fit in with Blood Atonement and White Horse Prophecy?
Oh, don't get me started. Yeah. So, so the White Horse Prophecy is this, you know, it was described to me when I first heard about it in like 2015 as a Mormon urban legend. The important thing to know is that the LDS Church has consistently throughout history said, like, we don't believe in this. This is not a part of our church. But the gist of it is that a man revealed after Joseph Smith died that Joseph Smith had told him that sometime in the future that the Constitution will hang by a thread as fine as silk fiber, and it will be up to the LDS people to save the Constitution and basically, you know, bring humanity back from the brink of disaster. So, you know, like I said, the LDS Church has said, yeah, we don't believe that, but it is very, very popular to believe that, specifically in this region of the West that this case happened in. Chad Daybo would often talk about other people who believed in that in his books. He would use that term, as fine as silk fiber or hang by a thread. Same with Lori's dad. He would write about that kind of thing. So, you know, I think when I first heard about the White Horse Prophecy, I thought, oh, it's not that big of a deal. Like, it's just this out there thing. And I reported that in some work that I did. And I heard from a lot of people who said, no, it's way more mainstream than you think. And this is kind of a part of Mormon culture that people don't like to talk about, is that there are people who believe that, you know, saving the Constitution and their religion go together. So to me, that's where I started to have some lights go off in terms of Chad's work, when I started to see those terms and kind of that regurgitation of the White Horse Prophecy idea. Blood Atonement is another thing that the church has been real cagey about whether or not they believe that, but it Brigham Young, who, you know, obviously BYU is named for, he was an acolyte of Joseph Smith that brought the Mormon people west to Utah. He had talked about that people might have to pay in the future for their sins by spilling their own blood. And there have been multiple instances where people have been killed in the name of fringe Mormon ideology, where people thought that they had to kill someone in order to absolve them of their sins, to allow them to go to heaven and things like that. So within, you know, the kind of online extremist movements that I think are, you know, we're talking a lot about now in American culture, there are groups of LDS men who are starting to kind of really get excited about that idea of blood atonement again. Do we need to kill people in order to make sure that this, you know, purified LDS people goes forward into the future? So these were all things I was kind of thinking about with Alex Cox and with Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. You know, was this a manifestation of their own belief in blood atonement, or their idea that they need to be the ones to save the Mormon people?
Well, that's where I felt like your book just really pulled together so many different things. Like I read Under the Banner of Heaven last year before we did some Mormon episodes, and I didn't know anything about that history and was, oh, and also it's my acting career coming back into it. I was auditioning for the TV series and I didn't know much about what happened to Brenda, and that's what the TV series was about. And I was, you know, researching it to interview John DeLynn at the same time auditioning for it, and just like really trying to get into the mindset and the character mindset. I was not a method actor, but just like really trying to understand it.
Yeah.
You know, and finding, and then reading this and just seeing how it all came together. Again, like I said at the beginning of the episode, just really feeling like you takes somebody who's interested in this case from a voyeuristic, like sensational perspective to a educated, compassionate human story of so many extreme beliefs as the backdrop.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I was somebody who read Under the Banner of Heaven by John Krakauer ages ago and thought, you know, it blew my mind. Like, I did not, you know, I always grew up, I knew a ton of Mormons when I was a kid. Is this the same thing? You know, it's not. And I think my goal was, when I wrote my book, was to, you know, take that foundation that Krakauer had built, that there's something about the LDS Church and its history that maybe should be examined a little bit closer, and kind of update that for this modern moment, and apply these other things that I feel like maybe are more mainstream. You know, that book is mostly about polygamy and blood atonement and things like that. But I thought, you know, those are really out. I mean, polygamous groups, I think, get a lot of attention, as they should. But, you know, the stuff around Lori and Chad is even more mainstream. It's the kind of thing you're going to see in a Phoenix suburb, like with Lori. So I thought that was important.
And why the title of the book?
Yeah. So two things. I'm a, you know, longtime heavy metal fan. So I wanted to write a book that sounded like it had a metal title, to be honest. Like, I thought, that sounds like a metal album. I would listen to that, When the Moon Turns to Blood.
We should talk.
So, yeah. So, but the other thing was, it's sort of, you know, you want heavy metal material. The Book of Revelation is a great, great source for that kind of thing. The things in the Bible that happen. There is a moment in the Book of Revelation when the moon turns red, that it's like, that there's sort of like blood dripping from the sky and things like that. And I just thought, that seems like a perfect illustration of what you would have to believe to follow Chad and Lori.
Definitely. Obviously, we're going to encourage people to read the book. And where else can they find you? Are you most active on a particular platform?
You know, I'm still doing a lot of tweeting, apparently. So I do tweet quite a bit, but I also have a newsletter, a Substack newsletter people can subscribe to. And I've been doing a lot of trial updates. So things that come out of the trial that maybe need a little bit more of a deep dive than what's, you know, the reporters who are there every day can do. So I've talked a little bit about the conferences, preparing of people and things like that. And some of these ideas that are being discussed in the trial that you might not understand what they're talking about. So yeah, Twitter and Substack, I would say, are the best places.
Okay, great. I look forward to catching up with you in a couple of weeks and hearing the latest breaking news on this crazy case. And thanks for your incredible reporting and for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Such a treat.
Thank you, Leah.
This podcast is brought to you by Citizens of Sound, a podcast production agency committed to developing and launching shows with gravity and depth. From conception to launch, Citizens will partner with you every step of the way, whether you're an actor, business owner, doctor, fitness coach, hairstylist, or influencer. Connection is the future of communication. Jump on board with Citizens of Sound today and start your show. Go to citizensofsound.com and follow them on Instagram. And trust me, it'll be a really good decision for you.
I love our interviews with journalists, Sarah.
It is nice to take a break from talking to survivors and just to learn the complexities of a case like this. I feel very grateful that she did the homework
For sure.
We didn't have to.
And they bring, you know, they bring new language to it, to stuff that doesn't have language. I think collectively, one of the things I love about what we're doing is we're bringing language to things that at first blush, people don't know what they're looking at. And the more you talk about it, the more people will recognize the symptoms. So when someone does go to the police and complains about these behaviors, the police don't side with the perpetrator. They actually can understand and recognize what the victims are saying to at least kick the tires a little bit more and not just take the story at first.
Exactly.
Dismissal.
And even though I didn't really know what I was talking about when Elizabeth Vargas interviewed me in a van down by the river in front of our
you
house
still gonna do a good
couple
job
weeks ago,
I still
stand by what I said. Yep. And one of the key points was that when people don't know what these things look like, it can end in tragedy. And this is a case that proves that just in the same vein as Jonestown, Waco, Heaven's Gate. And this is the exact same playbook. So I hope that this is an opportunity for law enforcement and people in positions of authority to know what it looks like. And so they will not let it get to this extreme case.
Thank you, Leah, for your work.
Thank you, Leah. Oh, one more thing. Y'all, if you are in Portland, near Portland, or willing to travel to Portland, please come see me do my first TEDx talk. It'll be May 20th at the Keller Auditorium. I have 100 books to sign and give away. I'd love to meet you, high-five you, and just have you in the audience for support. Please do come and come say hi. I hope you can be there. See you on Zoom on Patreon. Bye, everybody. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Hope you liked this episode. Let's keep the conversation going and come hang out with us on Patreon, where we keep the tape rolling each week with special episodes just for Patreon subscribers and where we get deep into the weeds of unpacking every episode of The Vow.
And if you're looking for our show notes or some sweet, sweet swag or official ALBC podcast merch or a list of our most recommended cult recovery resources, visit our website at alittlebitculty.com.
And for more background on what brought us here, check out Sarah's page-turning memoir. It's called Scarred: True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life. It's available on Amazon, Audible, narrated by my wife, and at most bookstores.
A Little Bit Culty is a Talkhouse podcast and a Trace 120 production. We're executive produced by Sarah Edmondson and Anthony Nippy Ames, with writing, research, and additional production support by senior producer Jess Tardy. We're edited, mixed, and mastered by our rocking producer, Will Rutherford of Citizens of Sound. And our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Aslan. Thank you for listening.